This is John Huckle, recorded at his home in Monmouth by Felicity Aston on the 25th of October 2010.
Well, apparently my name is John Huckle, and I was born on the 22nd of June 1924, which is a hell of a long time ago.
And your place of birth?
Abbots Langley, Hertfordshire.
So, John, in your last interview, we covered your naval career and your time with FIDS. But I'd like to ask you about the FIDAS expedition. Can you explain what the expedition was about?
Yes, I suspect it was part of our IGY contribution, International Geophysical Year contribution, to do a aerial survey of the Falkland Islands and the Falkland Islands dependencies. That was the object of the evolution. The first year was a bit of a disaster. And in fact, my involvement later with it in during the second year of the expedition was entirely due to that disaster in the first year, which was a complete misunderstanding between the expedition leader, Peter Mott, and the captain of the Olaf Sven, which was the base ship of the expedition for carrying the helicopter to land surveyors to check exact positions to be used as fixes along the coast. Now, the misunderstanding was really very understanding. But the funny thing was that until the second year, they didn't actually, either of them, appreciate what had happened. Peter Mott chartered the Olaf Sven for the expedition. He was the expedition leader and director of huntings. And he chartered this vessel with a very competent and experienced captain, Reiger. Now, Reiger was asked, if we ask you to sail from A to B, will you be able to get to B for us? And he said, yes, of course, I'm perfectly competent, I'll do that, you see. And when they got to the Antarctic, Peter Mott asked him to sail for somewhere. And when they got there, of course, it wasn't there, because the chart was probably about 10 miles out in this instance. And Reiger said to Mott, well, the place you want me to go to isn't there. I'm sure I'm in the right position. And Mott said, oh, well, of course, the chart's wrong. And Reiger got quite indignant about this and said, well, the chart's the one you've supplied. I've got you to the position you wanted. And Mott said, oh, but we're here to correct the charts. And poor old Reiger hadn't the faintest idea that that was what they were going to do. He thought he'd been contracted simply to get them from A to B. Nobody had mentioned to him that B might be miles out of position and he'd have to find it when he got there. And this caused a complete misunderstanding, and it's brought out in some respects in Peter Mott's book, Winds Over Ice, but I heard it from both sides and the sides were identical. Reiger didn't understand he'd been chartered to sail a ship to the Antarctic to survey the coast and correct the charts, and Mott thought that any captain sailing to the Antarctic with a survey ship would know the charts were inaccurate. And that was... And it so happened that when Mott got back into Port Stanley after the fairly horrendous first season, he said to me, I wish you could come down and help us with the ship's crew and captain. He had trouble with the rest of the crew as well, who were all Danes. And I said, well, I don't think I can, but I've got a long leave due to me. This was after I'd done about 6 years in the Falklands. And I might be able to wangle that I could spend some of my leave at least with you, if that would be of any help. That's roughly how I got started with FIDASI. Now, it continued from there when I decided that I'd really got just about as far as I could go in the Falklands. I was then, as I think Eldon Lee got last year, I'd got a sort of rather exotic titles of Queen's Harbour Master and Director of Civil Aviation. It sounds very wonderful. There are only 2,000 people in the Falklands, so it wasn't all that wonderful. But the fact is that by sort of fifth or sixth year, there was no hope whatever that I'd get any further promotion because I'd got to the top of the tree. Added to which I'd arranged to train a Falkland Islander to take over the flying duties I was performing. So I wasn't even going to have my flying to do. And when Peter Mott said, would I go to South with him for the second year, I did rather jump at that opportunity. And then I resigned from the government, and I did have their permission to use my leave to go south with Fardassi, and that's how I came to be involved. It was a little bit complicated getting onto the Olaf's Fen as a crew member because I was on a Falkland Island passport at the time. I had a British Master's certificate, but it was due to an exemption from my naval service, which was a rather odd thing. And the Olaf's Fen, of course, was under the Danish Ministry of Marine, who sort of looked at these papers when I said, can I serve as an officer on board? And they didn't quite know what to do about it. They asked me a lot of funny questions about fishing vessels and what I'd do if I saw fishing vessels. And as that didn't appear to be particularly relevant to a voyage in the Antarctic waters, I probably made a mess of the answer. But anyhow, eventually they gave me what was called a mongstring brevis, which was a bit of paper saying that I could serve as a Danish merchant marine officer on board the Olaf's Fen. And the paper was a bit late in arriving. It didn't reach us until we got to Montevideo, and it came through the Danish embassy there. Anyhow, all's well that ended well. And I went down for the second season with Fardassi aboard the Olaf's Fen. Peter Mott always calls me the ice pilot and the navigator, but actually I was second mate. Now you've got that part.
So what was your role within the expedition? You were the ice pilot, but what were your main responsibilities on board?
Well, I was sort of responsible for the navigation, but then of course Rieger, ultimately, as all ship's masters, was the man in charge of the navigation. But he really did need a bit of help in understanding the fact that Antarctic charts were inaccurate. And I had a lot of luck in the first 2 or 3 weeks that we were down in the Bransfield Strait area, because I did know where some of the errors were, and I was able occasionally to sort of say to him, oh, Peter Mott wants us to go to such and such a place, and you'll probably find that sort of 5 or 6 miles further east or something like that. And fortunately, I think on nearly all occasions I was right about it. Now, you may think that 5 or 6 miles further east, it makes no difference. But in fact, if you were running a ship, because the poor old Olaf's Fen wasn't exactly Speedy Gonzales, and we were sort of cruising around at 10 knots. So 5 extra miles to go meant half an hour's extra. Now, when the expedition wanted to use the helicopter which we were carrying, it virtually meant the whole crew had to stop work and sort of attend to getting the helicopter up on deck and away and returned and all the rest of it. In other words, the crew's activities were concentrated on that. So occasionally, if you were, we'll say, half an hour late in getting to a position, the crew missed a meal because the meal coincided with the time they were supposed to be on deck, or vice versa. And anyhow, it did interfere with the running of the ship if you did have this extra distance to go. So in the end, Riker began to sort of recognise it was quite useful having somebody advising him in this way. And I knew the breakthrough had come when one day he turned to me and he said, "Ah, here comes Peter again. He'll want us to go somewhere which when we get there won't be there." And I knew then that once he started making a joke of it, he was sort of accepting the fact that he'd got somebody to help him along a bit.
So what were living conditions like on the OSF? What kind of
ship? Well, actually, I was perfectly all right as a ship's officer. I had my own cabin. But the expedition were a bit cramped. They had a part of the hold which was designated the village. The main hold, of course, was taken up by the helicopter and a lift on which the helicopter came up. And the hatches of the hold had been modified, so they all rolled back against the mast and were propped up against the mast. And in that way, the helicopter could take off and come back and land and load down again into its hangar on this lift. It worked quite well, excepting, of course, we had a problem. We'd only been operating, I suppose, about a fortnight, 3 weeks. I can't remember to be exact. But we hadn't been operating very long before we were sending a surveyor to the top of Tower Island by helicopter, and the helicopter, as it came into land, stirred up a great deal of loose powder snow, which gave the pilot a whiteout, and he unfortunately missed his landing, and the helicopter overturned, and of course it was smashed up, and this actually ruined the whole operation. There was a slightly funny side to this one. Later on, there was an inquiry into what had caused the crash, and that was held in Port Stanley by I think the Colonial Secretary, and he asked the surveyor on board the helicopter, or who'd been on board the helicopter, "What did you think when the helicopter overturned as you landed?" And the surveyor said, "Well, I didn't really know. It was the first time I'd ever flown in a helicopter and I didn't know quite what to expect. But it did seem a bit peculiar when I found myself hanging upside down." That's a true story, incidentally.
So you joined the Fidarsi expedition in its second season, so you were joining the crew. Had most of that crew already completed the first season, and what was the atmosphere?
Well, quite a few of the crew had been changed owing to Mott complaining about the whole conduct of the ship during the first season. I don't entirely agree with Peter Mott, but he did have grounds for complaint. And he did manage to get them to change a lot of the crew, but Mott was absolutely convinced he should have a different captain. Actually, he was wrong, and the owner of the Sven said, "Under no circumstances am I changing a competent, experienced captain who I've had for some years, just because you want him. If you want to get him changed, you'll have to change your ship." Where's that effect? I think it was probably more polite, but it was in those lines. And the crew, by and large, were actually in the second season, we had no trouble really with the crew at all. They were very good and very competent, and they did everything that was could be expected of them. But of course, the loss of that helicopter gave us one hell of a headache. We had to get another one, which meant going up to getting it flown out from Britain to Montevideo, then the Sven going up to Montevideo again, picking it up and bringing it back to the Antarctic, which was wasting an awful lot of the good summer months. Talking about surveyors, it's a thing I did mention with Eldon Lee, but another extraordinary coincidence occurred. When I got on board the Olaf Sven in Harwich, the surveyors from Fadasi Huntings were on board. Colin Brown, my old sledging companion, he was one of the two surveyors they were sending down. I did mention to Eldon Lee, Colin and I kept on meeting up quite unexpectedly throughout life. This was another unexpected meeting. And actually, just to finish that, round off that story, the fourth unexpected meeting was when I was flying down to oil rigs deep in the Sahara Desert, and Colin suddenly turned up to do a detailed survey of Tobruk.
So was it a good time on the ship? Was there a good sense of camaraderie as well?
Pardon me, but I had to do that. Okay. Yes. I think you could say that. The thing went quite well. We were all upset, obviously, about the loss of the helicopter, because it did set our work back, and it did limit how far we could get. But nevertheless, we did manage. Incidentally, on that helicopter crash, we couldn't get in with the Olaf Sven, obviously, right up close to Tower Island, and she was laying about 2 or 3 miles off, clear of a chain of rocks. And I took the ship's lifeboat in to land a climbing party that went up to bring the surveyor and the pilot down. They got there that evening, but by that time we had a gale blowing, and they didn't come down again until the next morning. I went in again the next day to pick them up. The climbing party was necessary because the top of Tower Island is a rounded hummock, and as you know, rounded hummocks of ice on land tend to develop crevasses as the edges fall away. So you did need a climbing party. You couldn't just tell the pilot and the surveyor to walk down, because they might have ended up in a crevasse. Actually, the crevasses weren't as bad as we feared, but there we are. That was the first of my boat episodes, if you want to call it that, with the Olaf Sven. We did have another one, which Peter Mott refers to in his book at some length. When we were, I think we were near Bluff Island down the coast, at the end of the Bransfield Strait. And when I first went out there in 1946 or 47, actually, Captain Burden of the Trapassi and I had looked for a passage that had been noted and described by a whaler, but had been put on the charts and then taken off because nobody could ever find it again. And I got some proof copies of the air survey, which showed where this passage behind an island might be. And I managed to persuade both Reiger and Mott I'd like to take the boat in to have a look and see if it was there. And I must admit, I'm not surprised that other ships had failed to see it. We got really quite close to the entrance, which was just behind the snout of a small glacier. And even when I'd got in the boat and gone there with the boat, I couldn't have been more than 200 yards away before I could see the entrance. And then we got inside and there was quite a decent passage through. And we came out on the other side, and the Olaf Sven, which had been waiting and looking for us, didn't see us until we suddenly seemed to shoot out of a rock cliff. And again, it was an obscured entrance, or exit in this case. The only remarkable thing about the passage from my angle was that there were literally dozens of sea leopards there, and I had no idea that sea leopards bred in a sort of colony disposition. I always thought they were rather a solitary animal, but there really were a very large number of sea leopards, and I'd never seen that before. I've never seen it since in the Antarctic. I often wonder whether they are still there. Probably the entrance would be easier to find now than it was in my day, because I'm pretty sure that glacier will have carved back and then you'll be able to see your way in. The exit through the cliff may be still a bit obscure. Anyhow, that was the story which Peter Mott wrote up with some enthusiasm, because he said I enjoyed it very much. Actually, I did, because it was something I hadn't done for years.
Can you tell me a bit about the helicopter that you were using? I mean, was it reliable, and what was that like to fly?
Well, I wasn't flying, you see. I was just, my only time with the helicopter might have been if we'd had to pass through an ice field and having to spot for leads. But in fact, we never did meet ice in that sort of quantities. So it was never necessary. You could see what you wanted to see from the bridge. It was a Bell helicopter, and they are good helicopters. I have flown them myself subsequently. And there was nothing wrong with the helicopter at all. It was actually, well, to be honest, pilot error. He shouldn't really, once he'd started stirring the snow up, he shouldn't have continued the landing. He should have taken off and come back to the ship and abandoned it. Because if you get a whiteout, you really lose all orientation. And this was in the days before we had all these sophisticated modern techniques for automatic hovers and things. You couldn't do it. The helicopter was perfectly reliable, and the second one performed very well indeed. I don't think it was anything really I can add to that.
And you've mentioned Peter Mott's book about the expedition a couple of times. What do you make of his account? Do you feel it's a fairly accurate description of the experience?
Well, I don't know about everybody else, but as far as its description of me is, it's grossly exaggerated. I wasn't anything like as important as he makes out. But there is an interesting, almost political with a small p, observation to make about that. He puts in a very nice acknowledgement at the end of how many miles of soundings I managed to take through sort of uncharted waters. Wasn't terribly important, because the ship had to go through these waters anyhow, and if it's going through the waters, you might as well take soundings. And as I was interested in the survey work, I could manage to plot my soundings to tie in with the new survey and so on. Anyhow, that was just something I did for interest. Peter Mott made it sound as a valuable contribution. something that anybody might have done. But there was a political side to this. After we'd finished the air survey work, we had a very good opportunity to amend the charts as they were to a very considerable extent and correcting quite large errors with this air survey. Unfortunately, before it could be published, the new charts were overtaken by what we'll call satellite pictures from these orbiting satellites, who could then produce an even more accurate chart. So our chart, and this actually poor Colin and I suffered this twice in our life. Our first charts from the King George VI Sound were quite a big improvement. We reckoned that we could get within a mile for the coastline. Actually, I regret to say that we were a bit out on that. There were errors still of 2.5 miles on our charts. But anyhow, we did improve because Terminal Island up the northern end of Alexander Land was very nearly 20 miles out when we got there. So we did improve those charts. But before the Directorate of Colonial Surveys could publish our results, we were being overtaken by the air survey. And before the air survey got its chance to be published, we were overtaken by these bloody satellites.
But at the end of your season, did you feel that you'd managed to complete the work regardless of the accident with the helicopter? I mean, was there a sense of that you'd been successful?
Oh, there was a definite sense that we'd been successful in so far as we'd managed to go. But we would have liked to have finished it right down, actually, to, I think, somewhere around 75 degrees south was probably where we were aiming to finish it. In other words, all of Alexander landing and cutting across the peninsula there, across to Ronnie Bay. Ronnie Shelf House. We wanted to finish off the main Antarctic Peninsula, and we didn't. We didn't manage to get past the northern tip of Adelaide Island with the air survey.
And was it hard work? And were there any sort of dangerous aspects to what you were doing?
Oh, you're one to ask that question. I don't know. I don't know you well enough, Felicity, but you can't answer it. I mean, you can't say that what you enjoy doing, even though it may be your work, if you really enjoy a thing, it isn't work. I mean, you're doing it. So to say, is it hard work? I mean, bits of it were difficult to do, yes. Now, danger, did you mention that?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Well, actually, Eldon Lee mentioned that. I always remember, I think it's Fridtjof Nansen's remark, a good explorer never has an adventure, because an adventure is an unexpected incident which should be planned against. In other words, you should never have unexpected incidents, so you don't have adventures. But, you know, one inevitably does have adventures, despite all the careful planning, and it doesn't matter how careful you are, you will get them. And after I'd done that interview with Eldon Lee, I was thinking about that side. I did mention the time I rather stupidly flew into these fumes from a volcano, which was a stupid thing to do, which shows in a way, I certainly hadn't planned that because I didn't expect to see a volcano that day. Now that was one thing. But another thing which was thought about was running into open water when you're sledging over frozen sea ice. I don't mean shelf ice, I mean actual sea ice, frozen sea, probably 3 or 4 meters thick. And twice I encountered that, once with Colin when we were going up towards Terminal Island at the end of Alexander Land, and I think we got within a mile or two of the open edge before we actually realised that there was open water beyond that, and any breakup of the ice would just drift out on an ice pan. And actually, in our case, that really would have been a disaster, because we hadn't got any radio, nobody in the base knew where we were or anything. And I had the same thing happen at the Maurice Faure Islands when Ken Blakelock and I were going out with supplies for Bernard Stonehouse on the Dion Islands. We were part of a depot laying trip, and whilst another couple took what we'd carried on to the Dions, Ken and I remained on the Maurice Faures for Ken to do a survey, because the Faures were completely uncharted. But in the evening we went to bed, turned in the tent. In the morning when we woke up, there was a water sky to the west. And I think I said to Ken, I'll just nip up on the top of the hill to have a look and see where the water's got to. And it was right up to the islands, so we had to beat a hasty retreat. And again, there is the danger. And after all, we did Fids or Bass has blossomed in this way when ice had broken up under a sledge party. Now, there's another thing that I'm sure you've encountered this, and if you haven't, you're probably going to meet it with me. We old timers tend to all the time sort of say, oh, it was terrible for us, we didn't have the clothing you've got, and we didn't have air support, and we didn't have radios, and we didn't have this, and we didn't have the other. But a thing which one's always got to remember, at least I have to remember, you won't have to, I have to remember that if you fall down a bloody crevasse, it's just as bad for you as it was for me. And equally, if you happen to be on sea ice that breaks up and you drift away out to sea in a blizzard, it's just as bad for the modern explorer as it was for us. There are a lot of other things as well I could say were. Actually, on this question of falling down a crevasse, when I got thinking about it, and I admit that I only thought of this because I was thinking you were coming to interview me, but when I was thinking about it, in some ways, we had an advantage. I had a dog team, and when we went on to crevassed glaciers, we put them on a fan trace, not the centre trace, which is a more easily controlled trace, but we put them on a fan trace so that each dog had its own individual line to the sledge. And you drove your dog team happily ahead of you, and if a snow bridge was going to give way, there's a very good chance it'd give way under one of the dogs. And that was an advantage we had over you people, because you had to fall down the bloody thing yourself. And actually, it was easy enough with the dogs on, only one on each line, to haul the dogs up individually, or just to haul them up, you know. They were heavy, but you could haul them out of a crevasse. It's a damn sight more difficult to get a man out who's fallen down, even though he's on a rope. However, it's just a little thought that when, if you ever meet one of us old timers saying, Oh, it was terribly difficult for us, and you had it all easy. You just quote them that. You had a dog tick falling down first.
That's a great story about the difference between ancient and modern explorers. Have you got any other thoughts?
Well, there was one example, actually, and it was the last time I left the Antarctic with an expedition of that sort. And that was, as we were leaving Deception, and we were in a great hurry to get out, we were coming up towards the Bellows, and it's only a fairly narrow entrance, it's perfectly navigable, but it's a fairly narrow entrance, and Riker was using the radar to con the ship out with, and he was giving the steering orders from the radar. I think Mott actually mentions this in his book. I was just leaning against the bridge window watching, and Riker suddenly said, "Oh, the radar's gone unserviceable. We should have to turn back and go into anchor again." And I said, "Don't worry, it's perfectly all right. I can see where we're going anyhow." And that was the ancient's way of doing it instead of using this modern radar.
Your time at Firdausi came to an end, but then you moved on. Was it after that that you started working with helicopters and whaling?
Yeah.
Right. So I think you've mentioned a little bit about how that came about. You were sent to Cheltenham to learn how to fly helicopters. And then you went back south again. So where exactly were you based when you were doing...
Well, you weren't based, you see. We the people who listen to this won't be able to hear it, but just behind you there is a picture of where I was based, and there is my helicopter flying over the stern of it. It's a bloody great ship, you see. It's a 14,000-ton whaling ship. And you sailed in October from Britain, and you did sperm whale fishing for a few weeks, and then you went on to whaling, and we then on one season we went right round Antarctica, and you had anything between 12 and 16 of those little catcher vessels with you, and they would bring their whales into the factory, and it would be hauled up the slipway at the stern, processed on the deck, and in other words, cut up. And to be fair, every portion of the whale that could possibly be used was used. And my job was to fly the helicopter out. And this really was the most stupid thing I've ever done in my life, because those old S-55 helicopters with the piston engine, this was before they had jet engines, the same aircraft fitted with a jet engine was quite a good aircraft. With the piston engine, you did run quite serious risks. And we were going out 100 miles from the factory ship, sometimes with no catchers anywhere near us at all. And if we'd have ditched, Selverson's did provide us with extremely good equipment. We had immersion suits on. We had dinghies strapped to our backside sitting in the helicopter so that when we ditched, we just climbed out of the window with a dinghy attached to us. Actually, Selverson's did everything they could for us. It was still an extremely silly thing to do. And in the time I was with Selverson, in 4 years, Selverson lost 4 out of 8 helicopters. Fortunately, we only lost one crew, or unfortunately, you could say, but it was fortunate that none of the other three were injured during the ditchings. But
were you aware that it was a dangerous thing to do at the time, or is it sort of in retrospect you're thinking actually that was quite a dangerous a dangerous activity, or were you aware of it as you were doing it?
Well, I think sometimes I used to think when we got to the end of a search at about 100 miles, sometimes 110 miles from the factory ship, I used to think it's a hell of a long bloody way back. But I wasn't so conscious that I was later. It was later that I learned how vulnerable helicopters can be to mishaps. And of course, nowadays, with the modern jet helicopter, ancient and modern again, but with the modern jet helicopter and a lot of instrumentation, a helicopter of that size would be quite safe going out that distance. But actually, no, it's something I'll tell you about later. Anyhow, that's the answer to your question. That's what I did, going out on a helicopter looking for whales.
So these were huge ships going out looking for these whales, and there was just one helicopter on board.
Was it we actually had two.
Of two. So how many crew and how many pilots did you
we have? We had three pilots and, three crews, two pilots for each helicopter. So we had six pilots altogether. And we had quite a very competent engineering staff. They were very good, actually. They used to keep us running. We had all the spares you could possibly imagine. As I say, Selvesons did do us very well.
And how often did you go out? Was this a...
Every day, if the weather was good, we had plenty of fuel and plenty of spare parts and everything. Down in Antarctica, as you know, you can have quite a considerable amount of down weather. And there's no point in searching for whales if you can't see sort of 5 or 6 miles at least. I mean, you know, otherwise you wouldn't have enough field of view to make it worth flying the thing.
What was it like being up there looking for whales? I mean, were they quite hard to find, or what was that like?
Actually, it was surprising. You had to be at the right height. But if you were at the right height, the height depended a bit on the line of the actual light, but if you were at the right height, you could see the spouts of whales quite distinctly. And then, of course, you flew over the spouts and identified the whales. The one which was difficult was the sperm whale, which would spout two or three times and then dive, and it would stay down for 20 minutes, sometimes half an hour, before it comes up and breathes again. And you had to sort of look around all the time for half an hour waiting for it. And they did tend to be rather singletons, but they liked to catch those because the sperm oil was very valuable. And you'd call a catcher up, and it's just occasionally you'd call a catcher up and he'd arrive and actually see the whale when it spouted, you know, another time. I think the helicopters did pay for themselves, and Selvesons obviously thought so, otherwise we wouldn't have persevered with them. But I have a views about whaling. My whaling ended when the campaign, anti-whaling campaign in Britain, gathered momentum, and very often the campaigners claimed that they stopped whaling. Actually, whaling didn't stop because of the campaign of anti-whaling. And some of the remarks that were made were ridiculous. One of the ones that stuck in all our gullets was whaling was deliberately cruel. Whale catchers, the gunners, played a whale like a fisherman plays a trout or a salmon. Well, they didn't. They did nothing of the sort, because the gunners and their crews were on a bonus for killing whales, and if they killed a whale quickly, they could then get on to hunting another one and kill another one quickly. So the emphasis for the whalers was to kill a whale as quickly and as efficiently as possible. That's one thing. The other thing that came into this was that it was economics that finished our whaling. As you can see from that picture that we've looked at, these expeditions were very costly, obviously. I mean, a huge ship like that and all those 12, 15 catchers and two helicopters on each factory, they cost a great deal of money. And if you don't catch enough whales, then it's uneconomic to go on whaling. And that was what stopped whaling. Now, you may say, well, that was a thoroughly good thing, and indeed it was. However, there was a lesson which I think is applicable today. When we were whaling, you were supposed by international agreement to catch whales which were large adult animals, not the younger breeding stock, and they had measurements, and we had whale inspectors on board who inspected every whale we caught to certify that they were over the length required. And if they were under the length required, then the gunner and his crew did not get a bonus for that whale. It was still brought on board the factory ship. It was still processed and oil and produced and everything else, but the gunner and his crew did not get a bonus. And those bonuses were quite large, added to which, not only did they lose their bonus, but they may have given up several hours, in fact, perhaps half a day or more, chasing that whale and getting very wet in the process and getting it in and all the rest of it. So there was no incentive to get an under-length whale. Now, the difference is we still made use of every bit of that whale. I'm watching what's happening in the sea fisheries around Britain at the moment, where if fishermen exceed their quota, they throw perfectly good fish over the side and waste them. In fact, the seagulls eat them. Well, I mean, I find that ridiculous, and surely they could learn from the whalers. Bring the fish in, sell them, but when they're sold, make sure that none of the money from the sale goes to the crew who caught the surplus quota.
So did you yourself notice the decline in the whales? Did they?
Oh, yes.
Did they get harder to find?
Oh, yeah. Certainly the last season I did, 1960, they were getting definitely very difficult. In fact, I had a rather remarkable thing. They were getting so difficult. I did a search with the helicopter through the Bransfield Strait again, looking for them in the area where we'd done the air survey and everything. And I was using a chart which was actually based on the air survey. So, in a way, I sort of did have a hand in producing the chart and then had a hand using it afterwards to navigate with.
So was that quite a dramatic change? I mean, the space of 4 years from being easy to find to... So in your opinion, what went wrong with what happened? Was it just more ships there?
The Japanese came in, the Russians came in. I'm not saying they were cheating. They may even have been keeping to the international rules. But there were Norwegians, British, Russians and Japanese. They were the main ones. And there were shore stations in South Africa and places like that. And of course, South Georgia was a whaling station. In fact, in 1958, there were three whaling stations operating in South Georgia, shore bases, and the whales were being brought into them. And it was just a massive slaughter of the whales. I also blame the scientists who did the annual estimate of what the what we're called quotas should be. Scientists never like to be wrong. I don't get the idea I'm anti-scientist, I'm not. But they never like to be wrong. They never like to admit they might have been mistaken. So the scientists every year used to come up with a figure of, oh, you can take 20,000 fin whale. I'm just quoting anything out of my head at the moment. But they'll come up with a figure like 20,000 fin whale. But then they'd go to the International Commission and say, but of course, it may be permissible to take 30,000 fin whale. We don't really know, but 20,000 is our estimate. Well, you can guess what the International Commission, which had representatives of the whaling nations and the whaling companies on it, you can guess what they said. Oh, well, we'll try 30,000. And every year, they always went to the upper limit that the scientists have said. I think had they stuck to the actual limit the scientists said was probably desirable, we might still be whaling ordinarily now.
And so seeing that sudden decline, how did you feel being involved in this, in the way?
Well, I only had 3 years. When I saw Carl Salveson and joined the whaling, I only had a three-year contract. I say I only had a three-year contract. I had a three-year contract, and I decided not to renew it. That was very largely because by the time I ended with Salveson's, you know, this sounds like a lot of bullshit. You can leave that in. I had a landplane license, a seaplane license for operating ordinary aircraft on floats as well as on land, and a helicopter license. And this is 1960. And I don't think there were more than a couple of dozen pilots in the world who had all three. And there was one company which particularly wanted pilots with all three. And in consequence, because they were rare on the ground, the company was paying, well, what in those days was a very substantial salary. So when the end of my Salveson contract came and I got my helicopter license and hours in, I decided I wouldn't renew my contract with Salveson, so I would go for this other company who actually I ended my flying career with.
I was just interested at what the sort of atmosphere was, what the attitude towards the whales was within the whaling community as you're seeing this decline and on board the whaling ships. Were the people involved in the whaling sort of sad or concerned or just worried about the economic impact on their own jobs and livelihood?
Well, I think it's a mixture of all three, yes, because you see, it was a good livelihood for nearly all whalers. No matter what your position was, they were all making reasonable until the decline came, and then the salary or the money dropped off because you dropped off on bonuses and things. There were little perks. I'll describe one now. I don't think I can be had up after all these years. We used to have a long-range tank. It was a 40-gallon drum in the cockpit, the cabin, not the cockpit, in the cabin of those helicopters. And this was to give us the extra range so that we could, in fact, fly for 5 hours on our searches. And this drum had a drainage cock at the bottom so you could check whether it got any fuel in it or not, you see. Well, anyhow, we always flew off the whaling factory. When they were coming back every year, they were going up to Liverpool to offload their cargo. And we used to fly off somewhere around the Scilly Isles and fly up to Exeter Airport, which was a customs airport. Now, we had a part of that fuel tank, the end could be unscrewed and taken off. And if you put a little shelf at the bottom, you could leave a few pints of petrol in the bottom of the tank, and then a little sort of shelf. And above that, you could put thousands of cigarettes, which of course were contraband. And you had thousands of cigarettes in it. Then you screwed the end back on again, you see. And of course, when the customs inspectors came on board, they didn't know very much about helicopters in those days. And they looked at this and they said, "What's this?" "Oh, that's the long-range tank. I expect there's still some fuel left in it." And you open the drain cock, let out a drop of fuel. "Oh, yes, it's still got fuel in." Shut the drain cock hastily. And the old customs inspectors were convinced the tank was full. Not of cigarettes. However, I don't suppose I should be charged now with customs duty.
So are there any other anecdotes from your whaling time that you'd like to share? Or?
No, I think I've practically run out of ideas. Well, I mean, it depends on how far you want to go. I mean, I've said that the Selversons were awfully good at providing most wonderfully sophisticated equipment for us. It really was. It was straight of the art of the day. I mean, you'd probably think it was pretty primitive, but we thought it was state of the art for the day. And we did have these immersion suits. Yes, there is a little story. We should have been elderly at the moment to tell this story, but anyhow, never mind. We did have a slight problem. We needed a relief tube on it. If you were flying for 5 hours in a cold helicopter, you needed, you needed some means of relieving the pressure, as it were. So they designed on this bloody suit a tube which fitted onto the front, and then you bent it over and bound it up so that it couldn't let in water. So if you were swimming around, no water would get in. But if you were in the helicopter seat and dying for a pee, you could undo your tube and use it for that purpose. However, I don't know who designed it, but it was a tube that was approximately 6 inches in length, and it had a bore of, well, not more than my little finger. And it was totally useless.
Oh, dear. Oh, it sounds uncomfortable.
Well, yes.